Of course we're aware of that. Very intelligent question. He offered Warden the kind of winning smile that would melt the thighs of 100 space princesses, but it bounced off her like a paper dart against a stone statue. Like I said, a lot of our money comes from fugitives seeking shelter. Frankly, we need to explore every available opportunity for funding. One of our top priorities when we negotiate trading and transport connections is to secure an intergalactically recognized amnesty for all crimes committed by our settlement team. Do you believe you will get it? I believe we're creating something here that human society wants, said Blaze. I believe they will want it more than justice for a few minor misdemeanors. I see, said Warden. The pirates who do not share your code, do they ever attempt to attack? You saw the defense system on your way in, didn't you? But how do you tell the difference between them and the members of your own community? Blaze shrugged. So far we get by just from everyone knowing each other. We have a man on every turret eyeballing the ships as they come in. I realize we will need something more efficient. Yes, you do, interrupted Warden. I have a contact at Argus Armaments. They've developed an automation system for turrets I could get for you at cost. You can make your turrets automatically fire upon any ship that does not transmit a unique code, which you give to all your friendlies. Blaze was stroking his beard, intrigued. That certainly does sound more efficient. We should have a serious talk about that in future. How are you for onboard armaments, computer systems? Blaze gave Warden a sidelong look. Penelope, wasn't it? He filled the glass in front of her with wine, which she politely ignored. I'm slightly afraid to ask who you used to work for, but I'm starting to think that their loss was my gain. Meanwhile, I'd been drinking increasingly and was starting to feel resentful, as if my date was chatting a little too flirtatiously with the waitress. You've got no idea, I said into Blaze's ear, one hand on his shoulder to keep myself steady. Here's why she did this whole kidnapping thing. Yeah, I totally won't press charges about that if you don't want, said Jemima. Daniel said something indistinct through a mouthful of dinosaur chicken nuggets. I imagine you would be more worried about the theft you have committed, said Warden, spearing me with a meaningful look. I frowned. What theft? You mean the ship? We didn't blow it up. I was actually referring to your recent windfall. Ah! I slapped the tabletop hard enough to make all the plates rattle. I realized I'd been handed the perfect opportunity to move toward an answer on the Jacques McKeown mystery. I leaned toward him, watching for changes in his face. I sort of accidentally nicked Jacques McKeown's money. Like, all of it. Blaze seemed nonplussed, but this was probably more to do with the way I was leaning into his personal space, carefully scrutinizing him with narrowed eyes. He politely leaned away. How did you do that? Accidentally. Funny story, I said. Keeping my head up was starting to take some effort, so I briefly rested it on his shoulder. His publisher mistook me for the real Jacques McKeown and sent me all his money he was supposed to get for all his tracky books he wrote. All his money? Asked Blaze, half smiling with his mouth and half frowning with his eyes. Dunno why he's never claimed it. I shook my head back and forth, grinding my chin into his shoulder. He doesn't return their calls or something. I'm not about to start looking for the real one, I tell you that. I mean, I stepped the scrutinizing look up a bit. He could be anywhere. Well, quite, said Blaze mollifyingly. You know, that's actually really interesting. Yes, well, returning to salient points, said Warden. Blaze ignored her outright. If that was all the money he's ever been owed for every single book, it must be a pretty huge sum. Yep, I said, draining my tumbler and holding it out meaningfully as Blaze reached for the jug. Don't even know what to do with it all. Maybe keep enough to keep myself going and give some to a charity for pilots or something. Well, they do say charity begins at home, you know, said Blaze, looking up at the light coming down from the skylight. I twigged what he was getting at after a few false starts and slammed my tumbler back down. creating a momentary little homebrew wine fountain that seriously contaminated my fries. "Oh, hey, yeah, this is totally a charity for pilots, isn't it? Well, maybe your Uncle Santa Jacques McKeown Claus will put a little present in your stocking if you be a very, 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 very good boy." More wine. Oh, good start. Chapter 18. And then I woke up. Which is to severely understate the massive amount of effort that went into it. My metabolism had been fighting a battle on the Russian front that was my liver since the moment I'd passed out, and it was frankly astonishing that I was even alive. My return to consciousness felt like an enormous sunken ship finally breaking surface after an all-night salvage operation. And then the chain snapped and the wreck crashed heavily back into the waves as the first pain in my head exploded. I don't know what they were making that homebrew wine out of, but the last time I'd had a headache this bad was after getting trapped in a fuel compartment for an hour without a breathing mask. My throat made a noise like the rumbling death throes of a trapped cow. "Oh, you're awake," said Warden. I lifted my head, which was a fairly weighty salvage operation in itself, and saw Warden sitting primly next to a fire. That helped flood some emergency activity into my limbs. I sat bolt upright. "Fire!" "Yes, that is a fire." "Put it out! You can't have fires on space stations!" "Good advice, but if you take a moment, you will notice that we are not currently on a space station." My sudden movement had summoned a swarm of spots before my eyes, but once they faded, I saw that she was right. I was lying on coarse sand, and the fire was in a ring of red stones in the center of a jungle clearing. The trees were a deep burgundy, and had grown into tentacle-like curves entirely uncharacteristic of trees of terrestrial origin. Through the gaps between the black leaves overhead, I saw a fire-orange sky, lit by two small rising suns. The next thing I noticed, for there was quite a long queue of things to get through, was Jemima, sitting on the third point of a triangle formed by me, her, and Warden around the fire. Both the women were giving me faintly accusatory looks. Next on the queue was a painful throbbing in my hand, which was readily explained by the bloody bandage wrapped around it. The question of where I was suddenly elbowed out of my head by the persistent ache. What happened to my hand? "Robert Blaze cut your ID chip out while you were unconscious," said Warden. "What?" I cradled my hand as if it were Robert Blaze's feelings, wounded by the accusation. "He wouldn't do that." "He kinda did," said Jemima. "Sorry." "But..." I poked at the reddest part of the bandage and felt pain, but not the reassuring bump of a subdermal chip. "He's a good guy." "He was apologizing a lot," said Jemima. "Yes, it took quite a lot of rationalization on his part," said Warden. "It was quite instructive to watch him going through the thought processes." "Why didn't you stop him?" I yelled. "Jemima tried," said Warden. Jemima glanced at her. "We both did, didn't we? That's why he put us down here. He said we needed to cool off. And he said to tell you when you woke up that he did say that he has to take every opportunity for funding he can get." She rolled her eyes upward as she remembered his words. "And that you'd probably have been totally persuaded to let him have all the money if you'd given him time, so he was just, you know, cutting that whole part out." I inspected my hand mournfully. "He's got my chip. He's got access to my bank account. Track." "Well, he wouldn't, would he?" said Jemima, frowning. "ID chips record your DNA and physical details and check they're still correct before they can be scanned, don't they?"
"Not off-world, Jemima," said Warden, like a middle school teacher correcting an oral presentation. "Once a Lunarian chip is extracted, a dedicated hacker could copy its information and paste it into a different one, and it would work perfectly well. Off-world chip IDs only record basic identification and do not make biometric security checks."
"Why not?"
"Maybe because our government isn't run by paranoid fascists," I suggested. Then I remembered what company I was in. "No offense."
"For what?" "Oh, right, Mum's thing."
She talked about the government of the UR like it was a Tupperware party that she was afraid to walk through in case several middle-aged women pinched her cheek and asked if she had a boyfriend yet. "Hang on a sec," I said, looking around the clearing. "Where's Daniel?" "Still with Blaze," said Warden, staring at the fire and allowing the slightest quantum of shame to drift into her voice. Henderson had been broadcasting an offer of reward. I think Blaze worked out Daniel's identity fairly quickly. "That's it," I said, snapping the fingers on my wounded hand and immediately regretting it. "That's what Blaze is doing. He's protecting us. He's hiding us on this planet until Henderson's men have come and taken Daniel back."
"Well, if that was his plan, he could have just told us," said Jemima, "without waving guns around and forcing us onto a shuttle."
"Or stealing your ID chip," pointed out Warden. "He had to have a good reason," I insisted. "He's the original star pilot. He's a hero a million times over. He..." I realized something as I was looking at Jemima, and my sentence screeched to a halt. "He cut out your ID chip," finished Warden, in very nearly a sing-song voice. "He exiled us to an alien planet?"
"He doesn't know about Jemima," I said, the words marching from my mouth in an ominous monotone.
"Henderson said he was going to tell Jemima's mum that we'd taken her hostage." "If it were known that the daughter of the United Republic President had been kidnapped and taken to the Black by off-worlders," thought Warden aloud, "then the President would undoubtedly call for a large-scale naval operation."
"No, she wouldn't," said Jemima with bitter conviction.
"I rather think she would," said Warden. Jemima hugged her knees and fiddled with the flaps on her sneakers.
"Well, you don't know her."
"How about we just assume she will," I suggested, "because if she does, a fleet of UR face stompers are going to show up at Salvation Station looking for you, and when you're not there, they're going to tear it apart." I was on my feet and pacing now. "Did Rob say when he was going to pick us back up?"
Warden made a contemptuous sound. "I, personally, am not holding out hope for that, and I don't see what you think you possibly owe him at this point."
I stood over her, and she remained seated, politely looking up at me as if I were merely taking her order. "It's about not grouping everyone into either assets or obstacles, all right? I don't care what Blaze did or why he did it. Salvation Station is bigger than just him, and I don't want to see it getting stomped."
"It's rare to see you so passionate," muttered Warden, almost without moving her lips.
"Right." I backed off, quivering with adrenaline. "Now, there's got to be something on this planet that can get Jemima back in the Black."
Jemima, who had spent the entire discourse since her last contribution, staring at the fire with her knees drawn up to her chest, suddenly unfolded like a trapdoor spider striking.
"Now you're doing it!" she yelled.
"What?
Talking about me like I'm an asset!"
She dropped into a silent huff for a second before changing her mind and jumping out of it again.
"I mean, this always happens to me. I want to do things, you know? I want to see things and hang out with people. But Mum only ever takes me out of the house so I could, you know, stand next to her while people take pictures."
My hand was aching, and I had decided I wasn't having any more of this Terran track. "Jemima, forgive me if the lives of the people on Salvation Station are more important to me than your desire for a proper holiday." She backed down, cowed.
"I know, I just... You could ask how I feel about all this. I'm not just some thing that has to be moved around and rescued, you know?"
And then the undergrowth behind her burst outward, and she was grabbed by a furious cyborg warrior. It had been human, or at least humanoid, but most of its flesh was covered or replaced by a mixture of metal and plastic. Except for a pair of red-tinted cybernetic goggles, its head was unaugmented, and its grey lips were pulled back into a grimace of hatred as it clutched Jemima around the waist. She yelled and struggled, her elbows bouncing off the cyborg's head and neck with no apparent effect. The intention seemed to have been to pick her up and drag her away, but it had underestimated either her weight or her unwillingness to keep still. I was already on my feet and had drawn and pointed my blaster before I'd fully digested the discovery that I was still carrying it. "Jemima," I called, "head down!" She got the idea, and with the cyborg's arm still fastened around her chest, she curled into the fetal position. The sudden concentration of weight bent the cyborg at the waist, and at the same moment, I fired the gun. The ball of energy struck the cyborg on the top of its bald scalp and tunneled through to its pelvis, leaving a ruined furrow of white-hot metal and melted skin. It dropped instantly, and Warden helped Jemima struggle out from under the dead weight.
"What the hell is it?"
cried Jemima, clutching at Warden fruitlessly for comfort. I kicked the body onto its back, and the two darkened red circles in its implanted eyes gazed blankly up at me. On closer inspection, it seemed like the head and a sizable chunk of the upper chest were all that remained of the original life form, and everything else was artificial. The limbs were titanium skeleton held together with pistons that looked powerful enough to crush diamond. The power unit was located in the belly area, with a coolant feed pipe leading from just underneath to between the legs. And then I was certain of what I had only suspected up to then. There were very few organizations of cyborgs designed with such a puerile sense of humor. "This track just got calculus," I breathed, poking at the ruined body. "What do you mean?" demanded Warden, who had been standing around stunned and useless for the whole encounter, but was now standing over the corpse with me trying to seem important. "It's a Malmind cyberzerker," I said.
"The Malmind? The Augmentation Collective?"
"Yeah, they take over planets. It's kind of all they do, actually. This is one of their infantry units."
"Why would an infantry unit for a hive mind be out here by itself?"
I glanced fearfully around at the surrounding jungle. I didn't see anything, but the background hum of animal noise could have been masking the movements of any number of stalking cyber Frankensteins eager to evangelize their collective in a way that did not involve pamphlets. "It wouldn't." I kept my gun ready. "We should move. And put the fire out, it could draw attention."
"Hey,
Jemima, more excited than traumatized, was crouching by the body.
"It, you know, it died kinda easy, didn't it?"
"It's a powerful gun," I said, still holding it as I stamped at the burning sticks. Although I did notice that it wasn't on the highest setting, and I'd seen cyberzerkers shrug off worse in the past. I nudged one of the body's fleshy parts with my toe and found it rather soft and yielding. Maybe this one had been assimilated more ineptly than usual. "Yes, and with limited charge, as I recall," said Warden huffily. "Perhaps you should put it away for now. In fact, perhaps I should—" "Yeah, no, never again," I said, shoving the blaster deep into my armpit region. She was right, though. There couldn't have been more than a couple of full-strength shots in the cell, which amounted to about 9 or 10 of the piddly little stun blasts. "Come on."
"It was weird, though,"
said Jemima, frowning, once we were crushing our way through overgrown vegetation with no particular preference for direction as long as it moved us away from all traces of murder cyborg.
"I mean, it wasn't pulling or trying to hurt me, it was just sort of holding on."
"Perhaps it was malfunctioning," suggested Warden, wearing a fixed grimace as she negotiated thick foliage and low-hanging branches in desperately inappropriate clothing. "It's possible," I said, taking point and keeping a close watch on the upcoming jungle, which thus far had been lifeless in a simultaneously reassuring and worrying way. "That might be a good sign, actually. Maybe it got separated from the rest of its unit. If it got far enough away, it would get some serious lag."
"How do you know so much about them?"
asked Jemima. "Fought against them in planetary wars back in the day," I said, trying to sound casual. "Kicked them off Cantrabarged. That's the routine. They try to take over a primitive planet. The nearest star pilot helps the locals fight them off. No big—" We suddenly reached the edge of the jungle and emerged into the bottom of a wide orange valley that snaked away into the distance. A narrow stream of water ran through the center of a wide riverbed. This must have been the dry season of a flood calendar not dissimilar to the one on— "Oh, track," I said, taking in the view. "We're on Cantrabarged, aren't we?"
"Yeah, I think Blaze said something about leaving us somewhere appropriate," said Jemima. "Wow, it's actually really, you know, beautiful here, isn't it?"
I didn't join her on that particular reverie, but locked eyes with Warden, who was wearing another of her neutral expressions. This was the one I'd come to associate with smug derision. Go on, then, say it, I said.
Excuse me?
You were going to say something like, oh, clearly you did an extremely thorough job of kicking the Malmind off Cantrabarjit, and it wouldn't have been the least bit constructive.
I can't imagine why you would assume I wanted to say such a thing, said Warden, with a subtly different neutral expression. I think that indicates your feelings more than mine.
It must have been alone, I insisted.
Yeah, now I know we're on Cantrabarjit, it's all making sense. It was a straggler from back in the war.
Been wandering alone without instructions since the retreat.
What's that noise?
I'd become aware of a rumble rising from the background wind, which was now separating into a thousand thuds of feet upon rough ground. I saw dust rising in the distance, where the valley snaked around and curved out of sight. A vast, broiling mass of life poured into view like a flash flood. A giant quilted bedspread of a thousand shades of nutty brown bore down the valley toward us, following the stream. We sheltered behind a convenient boulder as the stampede passed. It was a mass of furry creatures, bipedal and equipped with the usual accoutrements of a primitive race, tatty loincloths and spears, some of them riding large, bull-like domestic animals that had hair hanging over their eyes. They were all about 3 feet tall and bore a slight resemblance to upright sloths. They sped past us without even a glance, in a state of crazy-eyed, panicked mass exodus. The rumbling continued. I peered around our convenient boulder and saw what they were running from. No doubt about it now. It was the Malmind, out in force. A whole plying invasion unit, the kind that only has to position itself next to a village, march from one side to the other, and then there isn't a village anymore. There was a rectangular cohort of cyberzerkers like the one we'd just encountered, augmented humanoids, and in front of that was an advanced unit of converted sloth creatures with controllers bolted to their grimacing faces. They were marching after the fleeing natives in the kind of perfect step unique to cybernetic hive minds, with no regard for terrain or obstacle. This boulder we were hiding behind wouldn't even slow them down.
"What do we do?"
asked Jemima.
"Perhaps you should kick them off the planet again," said Warden.
"How about you go out there and see if your stand-up set gets any laughs?" I snarled. She didn't have a chance to deliver a no doubt unhelpful retort before we were interrupted by an urgent mooing sound and a spray of gravel. Some kind of vehicle had pulled up next to us, a sort of four-wheeled chariot pulled by a pair of the buffalo-like creatures I'd seen a couple of the sloths riding. The driver was, of all things, a human woman. A young one, early 20s or even late teens, but it was hard to tell through all the war paint on her face. She was Caucasian but tanned to a shade about halfway between latte and espresso, with blonde hair tied into rough dreadlocks. She was wearing garments not dissimilar to the ones that the sloths had on, by which I mean she was wearing two of them, one around the chest and one around the hips, neither of which were covering as much as they did on the sloths.
"Get in," she commanded.
We did so, the Malmind horde barely 50 yards away and closing, and the chariot jerkily took off. I'd gotten on last, old habits dying hard, and now found myself directly behind some kind of ballista mounted to the back of the chariot.
"Use it,"
instructed the driver, not looking away from the reins. I considered the Malmind horde, 100 lurching tech zombies loaded with enough augments to stop a bullet and absorb moderate blaster fire. Then I looked at what I was expected to slow them down with. The ballista's bolts were blunt, wooden, and each about a foot long and 2 inches wide. I might as well be throwing my shoes at them.
"This isn't going to do track," I said.
"Above," said the girl at the reins irritably. She evidently wasn't the most erudite conversationalist. But I could see what she was drawing my attention to. Above, on top of one of the valley walls, a number of sturdy-looking red boulders had been arranged precariously on the edge. The one in front was held in place with a wedge attached to a mechanism with a prominent red and white target painted on it. I immediately swung the ballista around and let a bolt fly. It sailed under the target and shattered against the rock wall.
"You need to aim higher," shouted Warden over the noise of the chariot, clinging to both sides for stability.
"Yes, all right, I've played Joogie Launch too." I went through the awkward but surprisingly intuitive process of loading another bolt and pulled the trigger again. The second shot clipped the side of the target, and after a bit of umming and ahhing among the components, the mechanism decided that this would suffice. A counterweight dropped, and the wedge was pulled out, sending a parade of boulders trundling directly into the path of the Malmind horde. They were slowing down. They must have seen what I was trying to do after the first miss, and realized with the eerie, instantaneous calculation of a machine mind that they weren't going to be able to get ahead of the rockfall in time. By the time the rocks swept across, blocking our view of the army, they had stopped completely.
"Yes!"
cried Jemima, sitting beside me and pumping a fist.
"We beat them!"
The carriage gave a sudden lurch of speed to narrowly avoid an errant boulder, and I had to grab her shoulder to stop her from falling out.
"Not beaten," said the driver gruffly, whipping the reins again. "Just escaped alive."
I turned in my seat to look at the strange girl again. Despite her youth, she controlled the chariot with practiced skill, and while the two sons of Cantrabarjit had tanned her almost to a Henderson level of dull orange, her flesh didn't look overly leathery or muscular. My curious gaze scanned up and down her body, then a little further down. Then I noticed Warden watching me, and I hastily took it all the way down to the wooden floor.
"This is a very well-made chariot you have here," I offered.
"Yeah," said the driver over her shoulder, slightly baffled. The mass exodus of sloth things for which we were apparently serving as rear guard made its way through the valley, passing the jungle we had woken up in on the right, until the walls of the valley began to sink into the ground and the terrain shifted into flat, rocky plains. The Malmind didn't seem to be following, so the column of fleeing sloths became more of a miserable march, with the chariot slowing down enough to go a little easier on the rough terrain. It meant we could finally have something resembling a proper conversation, which we were well overdue for.
"All right," I said, mentally stacking up my list of questions. "What is this all about?"
"That was the Malmind, wasn't it?"
"The metal men drove us out," said the girl. "Took our village. Some were caught. They were made like them."
"Yep, sounds like the Malmind, all right," I said. Warden took over for the next obvious question. "And who are you?"
"Alice," said the native girl. "I live with the Ruggles. I was left on this planet when I was 12.
The Ruggles presumably being the sloth-like creatures all around us.
"When you were 12?
I asked. "So that would have been, what, 9-10 years ago?"
"Why do you ask?" inquired Warden, one eye narrowed.
"So what happened to the Zavirons?"
By this stage the chariot had slowed down to a walking pace, so Alice was able to look away from the road for long enough to give me a protracted sidelong stare.
"The what?"
"You could hardly have missed them," I said, slightly aghast.
"Dominant species? 8 feet tall? 4 arms? Always going on about honour and swords?"
"Never seen anything like that," said Alice. "Only ever Ruggles."
Jemima, who had been kneeling upright on the side of the chariot, taking in the sight of the seemingly infinite orange plain stretching to the horizon, chipped in.
"Maybe this isn't actually the planet you thought it was."
That would have been an appealing thought, and one I would very much like to have believed, as it would have meant my time spent fighting the Malmind alongside the Zavirons hadn't been a complete waste. But it just didn't sit right as the two familiar suns beamed down.
"It looks exactly like it, though."
"Perhaps the Malmind have a type of planet that they prefer?" suggested Warden. I slackened my jaw at her in contempt.
"Warden, they're an intergalactic machine intelligence that turns all sentient life into more of themselves. They are not fussy. They do not hold out for a planet with nicer beaches."
I looked up into the sky again.
"I don't know, though. Maybe it is just a massive coincidence. Nothing new under the suns, is there?"
"I can't believe there was ever a war fought here,"
said Jemima in a breathy voice, drinking it all in.
"It's so peaceful."
"Yeah, that's how you can tell that there was a war fought here, Jemima," I said.
The procession slowed. The Ruggles at the head of the march must have established a campsite, and by the time we arrived, most of them had staked a claim on a few square feet of space, throwing down as bedding whatever items they had been able to grab in their escape. 6 or 7 were working to gather brush for a fire, while another handful were gathering large stones to form a circle for it to go in. There was little conversation beyond the occasional squeak. They seem to have a remarkably good instinctive grasp of their assigned tasks and sleeping areas. I suspected that scent marking might have been involved, and resolved to be cautious about sitting down. As we dismounted from the chariot, Alice had a relieved reunion with what I presumed to be her adoptive family. Four of the Ruggles, three full-sized with grey streaks in their fur, one little more than a pup, hurled themselves at her and snuffled around her limbs fondly. We could hardly escape notice at that point, and the Ruggles approached us with sniffing, brown-eyed curiosity, keeping a wary distance of a couple of feet. Jemima outstretched a hand to pet one of the smaller ones, but it shied away and hid behind what may have been its parent. "How were you abandoned here?" I asked Alice, when she had shaken off the affectionate greeting. The Ruggles remained close enough that they could pass for a large furry skirt. "My parents were studying the Ruggles," she said, idly stroking a proffered head. "They left me with them when they went off into the jungle. Didn't come back." "Is that so?" said Warden. I looked at her questioningly, and she raised an eyebrow in reply. "You can stay here tonight," said Alice, pointing to a vacant area on the outskirts of the camp where by some prearranged signal some bedrolls had been set up. "Tomorrow we take our village back." It hadn't sounded like a rousing clarion call to action, but the fire roared into life with remarkably good timing, and an adorable squeak of defiance sounded throughout the campsite. Chapter 19. It surprised me that, having spent the afternoon fleeing for their lives, the Ruggles were intent on having a bonfire party the same night. But from what Alice was saying, it seemed like a cultural thing. "Most important time to celebrate," she said, as food was served and a ring of Ruggles joined hands around the fire. "Bad days are there to remind us of the good ones." The food consisted mainly of haunches of meat, presumably from the domestic cow things I'd seen, with some wild fruit and root vegetables, but I found it surprisingly palatable. We ate reclined around a large ground sheet with the food laid out in unhygienic piles in the middle. Warden excused herself fairly swiftly, after consuming the bare minimum required for continued survival, while Jemima went to sit by the fire, swaying gently as she watched the younger Ruggles dance. I found myself alone with Alice, which presented an opportunity to ask something that had been nagging me. "You said your parents brought you down here, then disappeared on some kind of expedition," I said, putting down my current haunch.
"Yes,"
she replied, her mouth full. "How did you get down here? On a ship?" She nodded. "Is the ship still around?" That was the first of my two big questions. "Hasn't been used since then," said Alice, suddenly wary, having perhaps anticipated what the second of my two big questions was going to be. And here it came. "Can we borrow it?" She smiled deviously, in the way a child would when they are about to run to the teacher with a cry of "Telling!" "You mean, can you take it?" I gave an embarrassed and hopefully friendly-sounding laugh. "If you don't know how to fly it, then it's not much use to you, is it? I could fly it. I'm a pilot, and I have a rather pressing need to get back to where I was before." "If you don't know where it is, then it's not much use to you either, is it?" she said, imitating my voice. "It's back in the Ruggle village," I deduced, "where the Malmind are." She cocked her head coyly. "Help us chase them out, then you can get what you want." I couldn't deny that I was thrumming with excitement at the thought. Helping primitive people fight off the Malmind was something so perfectly attuned to my narrow skill set that only the word serendipitous sufficed. But through that giddy excitement, I sensed a note of resentment in Alice's last few words, and some bitterness in the way she was tearing meat from the bone in front of her with her teeth. "I could fly you off here as well, you know," I offered. Baffled, she made a show of looking at the many reveling Ruggles within our field of view. "And go where?" I shrugged. "Fair enough." But she didn't seem to want to let it drop. She had put her food down now and was staring at me, reclining on her side with her arm as a pillow. "So where are you going back to?" I was about to say Ritsuko City, in the prideful way we citizens of the first and biggest off-Earth colony tend to use, but then I remembered the whole marked for death by entire peer group thing, There's a space station full of people like me, I said, looking up into the night sky as if I'd be able to see it. If we don't get back there, a lot of trouble might be coming their way. Are they your friends? I looked sadly at the fraying bandage on my hand. The dark red stain in the middle was like a single eye, staring back like the reproachful gaze of a kicked puppy. I have to assume so. Why? I was too sleepy and full of greasy food to wrestle with philosophy. I rose to my feet, brushing the dust and sand from my jeans. Can I get back to you on that one? We can talk about taking the village back first thing in the morning. She shrugged and returned to the food pile as I gingerly stepped around the numerous sleeping bodies of the older and better-fed Ruggles who weren't joining in the festivities, making my way to our assigned sleeping area. Warden was there, sitting on a stone with crossed legs, making notes on her tablet. Hey, I said, staking a claim on a bedroll by sitting on it. I think I know how to get us off this planet. An eyebrow raised, and Warden's skittering finger halted abruptly on the surface of her touchscreen. Oh? Now holding new cards that she didn't know about, I felt my mood improve further. Unless you're more interested in your tablet, of course. McYone, she began, warningly. Alice has a ship. She can't fly it, and it's in the Ruggle village under Malmind control. But we can have it if we help them retake it. I blinked once. And you can stop calling me McYone now, you know. I don't know what your real name is. You must know, because you changed it on the ID network. I think you know perfectly well why that wouldn't clarify the matter. She sighed through her teeth. Do you trust them? I trust them more than the Malmind, and we have to trust someone. Could you just drop the plying aloof thing? I am trying to get us all off this planet. You could at least get on board. I'm not asking for gratitude, because I appreciate that that would be like asking a Sliggan for tap dancing lessons. Forgive me if gratitude is not the first thing on my mind, said Warden, meeting my gaze sternly. When, after finally finding a place that can shelter me from Henderson, and where I can make a real difference, I am immediately exiled to an alien planet because someone couldn't keep their intoxicated mouth shut. I unfolded two fingers, firstly as an obscene gesture, and secondly to count them off. Okay, one, you were the one who brought up McKeown's money at dinner, and two, I just told you I have a way to fix this. What is your problem? She broke off her gaze. I could almost have said that Warden looked guilty. It was a very, very brief glimpse, and was swiftly replaced with a more familiar neutral look with the usual mix of contempt and grudging tolerance, but I was sure I'd seen it. McYone, something is not right about this whole situation. I nodded, exaggerating a stupid grin. Yeah, there is something pretty not right about the Malmind occupying the Ruggle village. That's why I'm proposing we do something about it. I mean, the entire situation. The Malmind, the Ruggles, Alice, the whole planet. There's something wrong. I frowned. Well? Her mouth did a few laps around the lower half of her face as she picked through the best words to use. It's too... Her hands came up, jiggled around, then went down again. Cute. I treated her to a long pause, maintaining eye contact throughout, then echoed, cute. Too obvious, she tried. Too clear-cut, perhaps. I get a sense that one or all parties are trying too hard. I sighed and leaned back. That's your reasoning, is it? Sorry, Ruggles, we can't avenge your lost and wounded and help you retake your ancestral home, nor accept your gift of a ship that will let us get off this planet, for I'm afraid the psycho div over here thinks you're too cute and trying too hard. I did not say I was not in favour of such a deal, she said, tightening her mouth and spitting each word. I am trying to make you understand that there may be more to this situation than first meets the eye. A number of things have not been adding up. Like what? She indicated straight downwards. This camp has been put together from what little could be seized at a moment's notice from the Ruggle village, yes? Yeah. So why, among the items grabbed in those first moments of panic and flight, were there three human-sized bedrolls? I looked down and inspected the rough cloth beneath me. It was definitely too big for a Ruggle, and looking around I saw that all the sleeping Ruggles were using properly proportioned bedrolls. "Maybe they're not actually bedrolls," I said. "Maybe they had some other purpose, like carrying stuff on one of those domesticated animals they have. It's just a big thick sack, right?" And anyway, Alice said her parents were here too at some point. 3 humans, 3 bedrolls. It doesn't explain why they brought all 3 if only 1 human currently resides here, said Warden. There's more. What about those mechanisms you used to cause the rockfall when the Malmind were chasing us?
What about them?
They're a fairly standard defensive measure for primitive cultures. The Ruggles must have been expecting an attack at some point.
But I can't think of any reason why the Ruggles would also paint obvious targets onto them, said Warden.
I mean, they know where they were, and that they had to be shot. Painting targets on them just draws attention to them. The Malmind could easily have spotted them, perhaps even used them against the Ruggles.
What exactly do you think that indicates, Warden? That the Ruggles were in on their own invasion?
They were probably just being thick. They can't be the brightest stars in the cosmos. If they were, they'd have invented the internal combustion engine by now.
The party seemed to be dying down, along with the fire. Most of the Ruggles had drifted off to their sleeping area.
Warden and I watched the silhouette of Alice against the dying embers, dutifully helping the more civic-minded creatures tidy up the remains of the banquet.
"There's something strange about that girl, too," said Warden.
"Ugh." I mimed being knocked backward by an invisible wave of stupid and lay back on my bedroll, hands behind my head. "Will you just leave me out of your plying, paranoid track?"
She leaned over me, not taking the hint.
What kind of parents leave their child with the primitive species they are trying to study? For that matter, what kind of parents bring their child to an uncivilized planet in the first place?
I rolled over and closed my eyes determinedly. And who would leave their child under the supervision of an imposter and a psycho-div? Some people just haven't got a Parents of the Year award on their priority list, is what I would be saying if I hadn't gone to sleep, snore, snore.
But didn't they tell anyone where they were going? Pressed Warden. Hasn't anyone noticed that they're missing?
I gave up and rolled back over, propping myself up on an elbow.
You know what I think this is all about? I think you're afraid of niceness.
That shut her up.
I... what?
Oh, I understand. Working with Henderson, you probably get used to niceness being the prelude to cassowary disembowelment. So when you see a perfectly straightforward situation, the nice, blameless, simple people being ousted by the evil Malmind, and that's pretty damn provably and unambiguously evil, take it from me, your first instinct is suspicion. You tell yourself there's got to be some hidden cassowary talon coming out of nowhere.
Do not think you understand me, McKeown.
I grinned at her discomfort.
But it's not just that, is it?
You're afraid of people being nice and uncomplicated because that means you'd have to be nice to them. And you couldn't abide that, could you? You'd think it would show weakness. You're afraid someone might get too close and see where the armor ends and the weakness begins.
Spare me your boneheaded pop psychology, snapped Warden, tightening her folded arms even further.
I settled back down to sleep, my point well made.
You only say that because you know I'm right.
She left a thoughtful pause, long enough to let me think she was going to let me have the last word for once, and I could finally get some shut-eye.
So what about you?
Hmm?
If it's pop psychology we're doing, have you considered that your problem is that you find it impossible to move on from your past glory days?
All right, you've got me there. I do think the golden age of star piloting was more agreeable than whatever the hell color of age you'd call this one.
But that's why you've been so eager to trust lately, why you refuse to accept that Robert Blaze betrayed you, why you will so readily accept the situation on this planet. The chance of going back to your old fantasy life is being dangled over your nose and you roll over like a dog.
I sat up again. It had been a while since I'd done this many sit-ups in one session.
Well, at least there has been one thing in my life I took pleasure from. At least I'm not dead inside. And if rejecting your paranoid moon-landing conspiracy evidence makes me a stupid doggy on a leash, then call me Mr. Woofy, frankly.
I never said I had hard evidence, said Warden, remaining infuriatingly composed as always. Only a few nagging doubts.
Emphasis on the nagging. Well, I'll tell you what. You come with me and Alice to recon the Ruggle village tomorrow morning, and if we see a massive soundstage with buildings painted onto canvas sheets, then I'll admit you were right all along. Fine.
Why don't you two, you know, get a room?
Said Jemima, approaching our sleeping area. Warden and I gave her matching grimaces at the notion, and she smiled, embarrassed, before taking a seat on the last remaining bedroll. She seemed flushed and out of breath, but she hummed happily as she made to remove her big, fashionable shoes. "And where were you?" I asked.
"Oh, I just joined in with the dancing for a bit,"
admitted Jemima, still taking deep breaths to bring her heart rate down.
"Phew, they're just so cute, aren't they?"
"Yes, Warden was just saying how cute they are," I said, arms folded sulkily, realizing that the spectre of a decent night's sleep was drifting further away with every passing second. Jemima beamed.
"You know something? I really like it here."
Her face turned serious.
"We're going to help them, aren't we? Against the cyber things? You fought them before."
"Yes," said Warden disapprovingly. "That seems to be the sole point on which we are all agreed." Jemima gave a little snort, downgrading it to a nervous smile before it could break out into a full laugh.
"Wait, both of you agree? How did that happen?"
"Alice has a ship," I reported. "It's back in the Ruggle village. We help them retake it, we get away off this planet." Jemima's upbeat mood visibly went down the drain. Her hair's vibrant pink tint seemed to spontaneously darken a few shades.
"Oh, but we don't have to leave straight away, do we? They might need more help, you know, settling back in."
"I rather think we do," I said, becoming annoyed. "Because your mum's thugs are going to be showing up at Salvation Station pretty soon, and if you're not there, there's going to be a lot of face-stomping that could otherwise have been avoided."
"My mum isn't sending thugs!"
cried Jemima, flailing her hands for a moment before composing herself. "She probably hasn't even noticed I'm gone!
Stop thinking you understand what my mum is like! And anyway, the people at Salvation Station cut your chip out, stole all your money. You don't owe them anything."
"Jemima," I began, but that sentence went nowhere.
"And you,"
she said, turning her pointed finger to Warden,
"where else do you have to be? Your plan was to join the pirates, wasn't it? And then the pirates turned you out and left you on this planet. You don't belong there. And you can't go back to Earth either."
Spent, she slumped back down, thrusting her face into the space between her knees. Over the mass of quivering pink hair, Warden caught my gaze meaningfully.
"It's just,"
continued Jemima, uprighting herself with second wind acquired,
"everywhere up in space it's just been people trying to kill you and use you, and neither of you have anywhere to live, and nobody else cares. Why is it such a stupid idea to just, you know, stay here a bit longer? Here there's just..."
"Killer cyborgs," I said. "Jemima," said Warden with what amounted to warmth for her, "just because you want to rebel against your mother..."
"I'm not trying to rebel against my mother,"
said Jemima, swatting Warden ineffectually on her padded shoulder.
"I'm just saying you're totally overreacting."
"Jemima, your mother probably already believes that you have been kidnapped," said Warden, brushing her swatted shoulder with quick, severe strokes. "Just because she can be distant does not mean she has no concern for you at all." "Yeah," I said, feeling like someone with actual emotions should probably get involved in the conversation. "I mean, when I was a kid, I thought my mum didn't love me because she'd never buy me a cream-filled crepe from the bakery when we were walking past. She always pretended she couldn't hear me yelling. I thought she didn't care. But then I got older and I realized she just didn't want me to turn out fat and hideous like her." "And besides," said Warden, bulldozing me right back out of the conversation, "you are more than just your mother's daughter. You are part of the public perception of a nation's president, and with that you are a symbol of the nation. Any perceived affront upon you is an affront upon that nation, and I am certain they will respond accordingly."
"I didn't ask to be the symbol of a nation,"
spat Jemima, returning her chin to the cradle on her knees as she submitted to our combined assault. "Yeah, I imagine those pilots on Salvation won't remember asking for a jackboot facial either," I said, rolling over to turn my back on them. "I don't think that's on any of their plying day planners. Now I really am going to sleep. and I really was. Chapter 20. If the planet we were on wasn't Cantrabarjid, it was an uncanny doppelganger. It had the suns, the terrain, and the 30-hour rotation cycle, which meant I could get a generous 10 hours of sleep and have a bit of a lie-in before the sun rose. But then I was well-fed and energized, and was willing to be generous with the benefit of the doubt. Conditions for the evolution of life were strict enough that suitable planets tended to be a little bit samey. And it may even have been Cantrabarjid after all. It was a pretty big planet, and I'd not seen huge amounts of it the first time. Maybe this was another set of rocky orange plains on the opposite side of the planet from where the Zavirons lived. Contrary to bad fiction, like Jacques McKeown's, very few habitable planets have exactly the same terrain from pole to pole. But there's no reason there can't be two deserts. Mind you, they both had to be pretty damn big deserts. The Malmind War had seen skirmishes 18 miles wide, and after a punishingly long hike along the top of the valley wall in the cold morning sun, I stood atop a rock spire that served as a vantage point, and the desert was still stretching from horizon to horizon. "Stay low, McKeown, you'll be seen," said Warden, crouching beside my perch. "The Malmind don't look up," I said, attempting to memorize the layout of the Ruggle village, nestled in the huge bowl-shaped crater that seemed to mark the beginning of the valley. Design flaw. That's why it was always star pilots having to deal with them. They're very easy to bomb. "He's right," said Alice, who was kneeling unafraid at the very edge of the valley wall. "When they don't fight, they just stand around like farm animals grazing." The bowl must have once been a lake, which had long since shrunk down into the little watering hole around which the village was built, just as the valley must once have been a mighty river that was now the little stream. The houses were squat, uniform dwellings constructed from rough slabs the same colour as all the surrounding rock. Crouching low enough to squeeze inside Ruggle-shaped doors was apparently too complex an operation for an individual Malmind cyborg to process by itself, so most of them were following preset patrol routes along the roads and alleyways dividing the houses. The few patches of pale white flesh that were uncovered by cybernetic implants had been universally burned a vibrant pink by the sun. "They don't appear to be doing anything," said Warden, showing off those keen observational skills. "They're just occupying," I said, climbing down from my perch for the sake of a more face-to-face discussion. "They don't care about holding a village. They care about adding to their numbers. They're waiting for the Ruggles to come back and try to retake their homes." "Which we will," said Alice defiantly. "Not much chance of a surprise attack, then," said Warden unhappily. I blew air out of my cheeks and looked down at the village again. From there the Malmind could see along the valley for miles. An approach from that direction was far too obvious. But the walls of the crater were too steep. An invading force would need climbing equipment, and the descent would be slow. It would be almost as obvious as a frontal assault. "How did the Malmind take the village in the first place?" I asked Alice. "This is about as defensible as it gets." "I don't know," she replied. "It all happened so fast. They came out of nowhere." "How conveniently unspecific," said Warden, giving me one of her looks. Alice scowled, confused. My gaze drifted to a patch of dusty silver white that was poking up from between a couple of houses. Some old sheets had been thrown over it to help it blend in with the rest of the village, aesthetically speaking. But a nacelle is a difficult thing to disguise. It had to be Alice's parents' ship, unused for however many years, but intact enough to be beaten into a flying state, I was certain. "This would be so much easier if I had a ship," I thought aloud, then turned to Alice. "If I could get in there alone, get to the ship, maybe..." "Nope," she said with irritating speed. "Village first, then ship. Earn trust." I sighed. At some point when the Ruggles had been teaching her essential survival skills, there must have been a few basic lessons on contract negotiation. "You may have raised a relevant point," said Warden charitably. "It could be possible for one or two individuals to sneak into the village unnoticed by climbing down from the cliffs." "And then what?" I asked. "Break out the kung fu?" Warden surveyed the village, tapping her chin with one finger. then used the same finger to point. "What's that?" She was indicating a cylinder of tarnished silver that had been erected in the centre of the village on the bank of the watering hole. It was about 10 feet tall and held upright by a number of twisted metal limbs. About halfway up the cylinder, there were 4 extruding rubber tubes, currently dangling unused. As we watched, one of the malmined cyborgs, in response to some kind of signal, lurched up to the cylinder and placed one of the tubes into its mouth. The tube immediately stiffened as some hideous substance was passed through it into the cyborg. Like many things about the malmind, there was something indecent about the whole process that seemed completely unnecessary. "That's weird," I said. "What is?" "It's the hub cylinder. Dispenses nutrient fluid that keeps the units running. Also, the top part is a signal booster, receiving messages from the Malmind Central Corps and passing them on to the local forces. It's the focal point of every Malmind expedition. But it's weird." "What is?" repeated Warden patiently. "They're usually kept somewhere out of the way, because they're such an obvious weak point." I rubbed my chin. "Maybe it needs to be near a water source?" "So we destroy it, and they are helpless?" said Alice, punching her palm in triumph. I shook my head. "If they don't get orders from the Corps, they'll just continue following the last order received, and they can go for days without nutrients. They'd still have more than enough capacity to make us into Christmas decorations if we went in noisy." "But what if they were receiving different orders?" asked Warden. I looked at her questioningly, and she jiggled her tablet in response. Ply knows how she had been able to hold on to that thing all this time. It was probably because it was the closest thing she had to a soul. "You said it was a signal booster," continued Warden, double-checking what I presumed to be the suite of hacking tools she had installed. "If I can get close, I may be able to override that signal. If I can figure out what kind of machine code they use, I may even be able to reprogram them. If not, I can at the very least shut them down with code they don't understand." "How close is close?" I asked. From some mysterious pocket in her outfit, she produced a double-ended USB cable. It was about 2 feet long. "This close." I cocked an eyebrow at the village below us. "Are you honestly volunteering for the solo mission? 'Cause I am fully on board with that plan, and plying thrilled at the prospect." She took that on the chin. "No, McKeown, 2 of us should still be able to maintain the element of stealth. As the resident veteran of Malmind combat, I propose that you come with me in an advisory role." Yeah, I figured as much. I'm just a little concerned that help retake the Ruggle village has suddenly turned into single-handedly retake the Ruggle village. "We'll be ready with more rockfalls if you need to make an escape," said Alice. "But don't think about trying to take the ship." She patted her loincloth, which jangled musically. "I always keep the keys with me." "Didn't even cross my mind," I said, and I meant it. "I'll go back to the camp and get the climbing gear," said Alice, making to leave. "Now," said Warden. "Shouldn't we wait until darkness?" I shook my head. "Nope. Malmind have enhanced vision. We'd be the only ones with a disadvantage in darkness, so we should do it now. Unless you're having second thoughts in the cold light of day." "None at all," said Warden. She watched Alice scamper off back along the trail, and I could immediately tell that she was waiting for her to be completely out of earshot. "So?" "Yes," I said with an exaggerated, encouraging tone. Among what few bare essentials could be grabbed in a single panicky moment as they were ousted from their homes by a belligerent force, there was also, apparently, some climbing gear. I gestured to the village with an open palm. "They live surrounded by cliffs, and sloths climb a lot. It's probably an important part of their lives." "What about the ship?" "That will be an important part of our lives, or at least the continuation of them. What are you getting at?" "It seems odd that she would always be carrying the keys to a ship that she claims to have not used in close to a decade." I peered out toward the ship in question, still sitting visibly between Ruggle dwellings. Now that I was focusing on it, I noticed that some potted plants had been arranged around it artfully. "It hasn't been flown, no, but there's no reason she won't have been going inside it. Maybe that's where she sleeps. Maybe that's where she keeps the bedrolls and the climbing equipment. "Well, as long as you are satisfied, then forget I said anything," said Warden.
"Way ahead of you."
I half-heartedly scanned the village yet again. "I mean, what do you think this is going to turn out to be? A VR simulation they put us in while we were asleep?" "Of course not. Jemima and I were both awake for the whole trip from the station to the planet."
I raised my eyebrows. "So maybe it's just me who's in a VR simulation."
Warden shrugged. "You aren't, but there's no possible way I can prove that to you."
On second thought, a VR simulation would have more emotions than you."
I glanced back along the trail. The location of the Ruggle camp was indicated by a column of campfire smoke in the distance, like a single pencil mark across the orange sky.
"Do you think Jemima will be safe in the camp?"
"Safer than in the surrounding desert," said Warden, also staring at the smoke. "To the extent I am hoping that she will be dissuaded from trying to escape when we have to drag her back to her responsibilities."
"And yet here you are, having run away from all of yours."
"I only did so after careful consideration led to the conclusion that fleeing was the most logical course of action for me at that time," she said, sounding more than a little rehearsed. "She is merely being immature."
I nodded. "Funny. You ever think, between the three of us, we've sort of created a little impromptu family unit?" I had never heard a syllable infused with as much utter loathing and disgust as the next one to come out of her mouth. "No, I do not." I blinked. "Me neither."
After Alice returned with some ropes and climbing hooks, and immediately left again to wrangle up some more boulders for the valley escape route, Warden and I made our way around the lip of the crater, seeking the best spot to rappel down to. We found it in a small courtyard, right next to where Alice's ship was parked, backing onto the sheer cliff wall and decorated with a small well in the centre. It seemed to be the point of least Malmind concentration, and was well sheltered by buildings and the ship, and directly above it there was a sturdy, elongated boulder a few feet from the edge of the cliff, around which I began looping the rope. "You ever rappelled before?" I asked Warden, as she was standing nearby, pretending to look useful.
"Have you?" she asked, instantly getting on the defensive.
"Once or twice." I tied the rope into the standard star pilot's hitch, optimized for pulling cargo around in zero gravity. "Always from ships, though." I pulled the last loop tight with a flourish and gave her a smile. It wasn't returned. "You're really enjoying being the most qualified person for this situation, aren't you?"
"Only now that I can see it's bothering you," I said, passing the rope through my belt loops and feeding the rope down the cliff.
I could see a sentry in a position to spot us once we were low enough, but it wouldn't be a problem if we timed our descent to match the moments when it turned its back. "Okay. Hold the free end of the rope behind your back like this. Keep your legs spread apart on the way down, although I have a feeling you'll have difficulty with that part." She followed my directions resentfully, and the two of us carefully backed off the ledge. The hard part is always the requisite moment of terror when you learn whether or not the rope is going to take your weight, but after that it was simple enough, even with only 10 minutes of training. About a third of the way down, I cast a look over my shoulder at the village below.
"Okay, stop a second," I called.
Warden did so awkwardly, her sensible shoes scratching upon the rock, but I had to admit she was doing pretty well for someone in office attire.
"What is it?"
I cocked my head. "Look out on the roof of the two-story building. I presumed it was some Ruggle equivalent of a town hall. We go much lower, he'll spot us. We wait till his patrol turns around."
"Fair enough," said Warden.
The ropes went slack. We were in free fall for a blood-curdling couple of feet before we stopped sharply. The pair of us bounced freely on the ropes like a pair of rubber spiders before securing our feet on the rock wall again.
"What the hell happened?" I hissed, sweat dripping into my eyes.
Warden was looking up. "I suspect the tall rock you chose as our anchor just toppled onto its side," she said in a small voice.
"You sure?"
"Fairly." I followed her gaze. The morning sun was moving overhead, and the cliff we had descended so far was a sheet of black silhouetted against the brightening sky. And at some point since the last time I'd looked at it, the mass of black appeared to have grown a nose. Our two ropes dangled down from it like lengthy snot trails. Was as far as I got before I noticed that the nose was growing longer, and that I was still moving slowly downward as it did so. "Our weight is pulling the rock off the cliff," said Warden flatly. "Plying porous rocks," I said, kicking off the wall for a big jump down. "New plan, get down now, quick smart like." The two of us started bouncing our way down the wall with all consideration of stealth forgotten. My feet slammed into the cliff again and again, jarring my ankles and sending little bursts of dust and sand sprinkling down upon the courtyard below. The friction from the rope burned the skin from my palms. When I was about three-quarters of the way down, I risked a look up. The rock looked like it was more than half over the edge, and I could see it being pulled left and right in time with the hops of Warden and me. "Ply it," I thought. "This is the kind of thing we keep ourselves in good health for." I let go of the rope and spread my arms wide. The rope whizzed through my belt loops, sending me into a spin and whipping painfully against my stomach, but I forced myself not to panic. I went limp, closed my eyes, and recited something familiar and comforting in my head. I opted for the standard pre-flight checklist from the old Speedstar employee manual. I'd only gotten as far as ensure that all tray tables and footrests are stowed when I hit the ground. My spread-eagled body thudded onto the sand like a flipped pancake landing back in the pan, with an involuntary grunt from my lungs taking the place of the appetizing sizzle. Flat on my back, I watched Warden daintily make her way down the rest of the wall with considerably less concern now that the anchor was relieved of my weight. I passed the time by flexing each of my muscles one by one, testing for broken bones. By the time I'd gotten as far as the feet, she was standing over me. "Are you all right?"
"One more sec."
I rolled my ankles and went down the toes, curling each one in turn.
"Seems like it."
Against expectations, she offered a hand to help me up. Gratifying to know that chivalry still exists. I rubbed at my bruises, which took a bit of work because it felt like my entire body had been bruised simultaneously. "It would only count as chivalry," I said in a strained voice, "if you were a woman." I turned, then made immediate eye contact with a 6'5" armor-plated cyborg warrior. It was directly between us and the narrow passage that was the only way out of the courtyard. It froze when I noticed it, perhaps to send an update on the situation back to the Central Corps and wait for new orders, before outstretching its arms and lurching forward. Its one uncovered eye was wide with frozen hatred. I felt rock behind me. With no input on the part of my conscious mind, I had apparently backed up against the cliff. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Warden dangling from her rope again. "McKeown," she said, "pull." I got the idea, grabbed the trailing rope I had recently fallen from, and swung off it as the raw skin on my palms screamed in protest. As the two of us pulled and dangled like bell ringers, and the cyborg drew ever closer, I became certain that the rock was going to turn out to be completely secure, just to make this as wantonly cruel as possible. Then the sudden slackening of the rope sent me into the dust again, with Warden joining me for the second round. A moment later, a viciously heavy thud launched us both about 6 inches off the ground. There was now a very large rock in the courtyard, instead of a murderous cyberzerker. "Oh, calculus, it saw us. Now the whole collective knows we're here." "It knows that we are at this position," said Warden, dusting herself down primly. "Therefore, we endeavour to be in another position." "There's only one way to go," I said, indicating the narrow alleyway, whose far end my imagination was already furnishing with hordes of approaching cyborgs. "We can climb onto the ship." Warden made for Alice's shuttle,